Good evening, and welcome to another episode of Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, the world's premier transatlantic Hitchcock fan podcast show. My name is Chris Haig, I'm representing the UK, and tonight I am joined, as always, by my two favourite Canadians, save for Tatiana Maslany, Brandon J. Matala and Tom Caldwell. How are you doing tonight, guys?
Wonderful.
I'm sad now because I think I'm better than Tatiana Maslany.
Well, to be fair, you do have the advantage of that I know you and don't know her, but I just watched an interview with her on, it was like Stephen Colbert or something, and I was like, oh, I want to be her friend. And it was very...
Yeah, but I'm way hotter.
She has a Jake Gyllenhaal movie coming out.
She has what?
She has a movie coming out with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh, Jake Gyllenhaal.
Did I say that right?
Yeah. I think it's Gyllenhaal. I don't know. I've never actually... Yeah. Oh, that'd be why then. Okay. So tonight we are going to be talking about one of the surviving silent films from Hitchcock's back catalogue. It is 1927's The Ring. So we'll be talking about that in a bit.
I've got a synopsis if you'd like me to read that.
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to launch straight into that. And I will... hand it over to Tom to give us a brief synopsis and overview of The Ring.
Now, the summary is that Nellie, a ticket girl at a circus, finds herself the object of desire for both her fiancé, the celebrated boxer Jack One Round Sander, and an Australian named Bob Corby. Bob challenges Jack to a fight, and for the first time in his career, Jack is defeated. Bob steals Nellie away from him, but after a revenge match at the Albert Hall, Jack defeats the Australian and wins back the heart of his girlfriend. Aw.
Aw.
So they're back together at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting movie. Did you guys have any trouble watching it or finding it, technically?
Well, I had it on DVD myself, and I watched it the other morning, and... You know, this is my second viewing of this film. I've seen it once before, and the first time I watched it, I remember, like, really, again, because I have trouble watching silent films, I had a tough time watching, and this time, I didn't have a tough time watching, but I found after about half an hour that my mind started to wander a bit, so I would actually pause, get up and walk around for a couple minutes, and then come back, and then I would be fully immersed in the film again for about another half an hour. So I did that twice while I was watching the movie. I got up and walked around a bit.
Yeah.
The first time I watched it a week ago was on YouTube, and I found a totally silent version. No audio whatsoever. And it was hard. It was hard to watch. And I sat through it, and then just earlier today, getting ready for a show, I watched a DVD version with a soundtrack, and it was good. But parts of the soundtrack got really modern, and I was like,
yeah.
You would never hear this type of music back in the day. I want to hear the music from the organ or the piano or whatever, you know, three-piece combo they have in the movie theater. I want to hear music authentic to the day. Some of the music that I heard on the DVD was a little too modern, and I got the impression they were just kind of playing music from file, not necessarily that somebody composed music and said, okay, we're going to try and do a tribute composition of music orchestration.
Yeah. No, yeah, I've definitely heard one of the pieces in, like, a YouTuber video background before. So I was really thrown when I was like, traditional organ music, and then I was like, no, I've definitely heard this in the background of a commercial. So I don't know what the hell it was doing there, but it was only for like half an, like 30 seconds, and then it switched back, and I was just like, okay, whatever.
I was thrown off by, we're seeing the big boxing match at Albert Hall at one point, and it's a very busy, and they're using like a big bell, more like a gong.
Yeah.
And I would have wanted to hear, let's hear a gong at that point, when that club hits that gong. I want to hear a little nut. I don't expect sound effects throughout the entire film, but that's a pretty significant thing when you're talking about a boxing movie named The Ring. You know, I want to hear a ring of a bell once in a while.
Yeah. I don't think... I might be wrong, but I don't think in... Like, I mean, it's particularly in the 20s in terms of film, I don't think they did much in terms of diegetic sound, did they? They didn't do, like, rushing water or striking of bells or anything like that. It was just... just like playing an audio file over moving visuals. It wasn't anything more complicated than that.
Right. So
I get where you're coming from, but yeah, I don't think.
But a good composer, a composer that would have struck a composition or an orchestration just for the film, I think would have had a percussionist do.
They would have done something like that more modern. It's funny that you should mention that because alto saxophonist and rapper Soweto Kinch composed a background score for this film, and it was screamed with the live performance by Kinch and team. The first such performance outside of London was for the 17th International Film Festival of Kerala on the inaugural day on 8th of December 2012. So I wonder how that kind of score would be, because he's an alto saxophonist, but he's also a rapper.
You don't hear that combination very often.
No.
Yeah, I don't know that artist at all, but you know, he's 39 years old now, so he's born in January of 78 in London. And
wow,
jazz and hip hop artist. So
that would be, is that track available somewhere online?
I didn't look into it, so I'm not sure.
That would be interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm just not up on my alto saxophone playing rappers, I guess.
So as we move away from Tom's synopsis of the movie, we are now going to touch in with Brandon's kind of trivia time.
Yeah, there's lots of information on this movie. So The Ring is a 1927 film written and directed by Hitchcock, and it is one of Hitchcock's 9 surviving silent films. And The Ring has the distinction of being Hitchcock's only original screenplay, although he worked extensively alongside other writers throughout his career. So this was an original story by Hitchcock. Now, there's a lot of conflicting information as to the order of the films, The Ring, Downhill, and Easy Virtue, as to when they were made. So I've got books that say that The Ring was his fourth film, I've got books that say Downhill was his fourth film, and I've got stuff that says Easy Virtue was his fourth film. So we're proceeding in this with the list of dates that are listed for release dates on Wikipedia. So Wikipedia lists the theatrical release of the 1st of October 1927 in the UK, and is the second of 3 films directed by Hitchcock that was released in that year. And the next one actually was released only a couple of weeks later. And that'll be Downhill that we talk about right away. Well, next episode we'll be talking about Downhill. The film was made at Elstree Studios by the newly established British International Pictures. And they emerged as one of 2 major studios during the late 20s. And they began hiring leading directors from Britain and abroad. And it was Hitchcock's first film for the company, The Ring, after joining from Gainsborough Pictures. It was also the first ever film to be released by the company. And the film was produced by John Maxwell, who we'll talk about shortly. Now, Associated British Picture Corporation, which was originally the British International Pictures, they were a distribution and exhibition company active from 27 until 70, when it was absorbed into EMI. Now, they owned approximately 500 cinemas in Britain by 1943, and the studio was partly owned by Warner Brothers from about 40 until 1969. And the American company also had a stake in ABPC's distribution arm, Warner Pathé, from 58. It formed one half of a vertically integrated film industry duopoly in Britain with the Rank organization. Now, being founded in 1927 by the aforementioned Scottish solicitor John Maxwell after he'd purchased the British National Studios, and he merged it with his ABC Cinemas circuit, renaming it BIP. He appointed Joseph Grossman, formerly manager of the Stoll Studios, his studio manager, and during the early years, the company's most prominent work was that by Alfred Hitchcock, including the film Blackmail, usually regarded as the first all-talky British film, and we'll be talking about that in a couple of episodes. Now, Hitchcock left the company in 1933 to work for the rival British company, British Gaumont, but we'll talk about them later. Hitchcock was only 28 when he directed The Ring, but this was already the young filmmaker's fourth film, so the Wikipedia site lists this as his fourth. Hitchcock regularly attended boxing matches in London where he lived, and he was struck by the fact that a good number of the spectators appear from good backgrounds and dressed in white. He also noticed that fighters were sprinkled with champagne at the end of each round. It was these 2 details that persuaded the young Hitchcock to start his work on The Ring. Now, Rotten Tomatoes gives this film a 100% fresh rating from critics, but only 43% from audiences. That's pretty. That's quite the distance.
Yeah.
Is part of that the modern audience's difficulty with the silent film format?
Could very well be. I would have given it a low rating after my first view. Spoilers for how I feel about it now. So even in its original release, the film was a major critical success, but it went on a general release and was considered a box office failure. Now, as for people in the film, Carl Brisson played one round Jack Sander, and he was born Carl Frederick, I'm going to say Einar, E-J-N-A-R, Peterson. So Carl Frederick Einar Peterson. He was a Danish film actor and singer and appeared in 13 films between 1918 and 1935, including two films by Hitchcock. So we'll see him in The Ring and we'll see him again in The Manxman. In the 1934 film Murder at the Vanities, he introduced the popular song Cocktails for Two. Prior to his acting and singing career, Brisson was a prize fighter for a few short spells between 1912 and 1915. And he attracted attention when he appeared as Prince Danilo in the 1923 London production of The Merry Widow at Daly's. He appeared in the same role when it was revived at the Lyceum Theatre the following year and frequently reprised. Lillian Hall Davis played Mabel, and she was an English actress during the silent film era and featured in major roles in English film and a number of German, French, and Italian films. She was born as Lillian Hall Davis, and she was the daughter of a London taxi driver. Her films included a part-color version of E. Pegliaccia in 1923, The Passionate Adventure, which was a film that Hitchcock worked on in 1924, Blighty in 27, The Ring in 27, and The Farmer's Wife in 28, which is also another Hitchcock film, which we'll talk about in the future. And Hitchcock, at the time, considered her his favorite actress.
Aw.
No.
Ian Hunter played Bob Corby. Now, Ian was born in the Kenilworth area of Cape Town, South Africa, where he spent his childhood. In his teen years, he and his parents returned to the family in England to live. Sometime between that arrival and the early years of World War I, Hunter began exploring acting. But in 1917, at only 17 years of age, he joined the army to serve in France for the remainder of the First World War. Later, Hunter made his first trip to the States, Broadway, not Hollywood, because Basil Dean, the British actor and director, was producing Richard Brinsley's Sheridan's The School for Scandal at the Knickerbocker Theatre. Unfortunately, the production folded after one performance, and it was a more concerted effort with film the next year back in Britain and again with Kelleno. That was where he met film director Alfred Hitchcock in 1927 and was featured in The Ring, and he stayed on for Downhill. Forrest Harvey played played James Ware. Now, Forrest Harvey was an Irish film actor. Or Forrester Harvey was an Irish film actor. From 1922 until his death, Harvey appeared in more than 115 films.
Wow.
He was credited for about two-thirds of his film appearances, but some of his roles were uncredited. The burly actor with a mustache mostly played comic supporting roles, often as an innkeeper. His best-known role was Beamish in the first two Tarzan films, starring Johnny Weissmuller, and together with Claude Rains, he played the Invisible Man as a tavern owner and husband of a hysterical Una O'Connor, and in The Wolfman. He also appeared in two films for Hitchcock. The first was The Ring, and later he will be in Rebecca, which we'll be talking about down the road. Now, a number of reference works incorrectly identify him as having played Little Maria's father in Frankenstein. And now, normally I don't go this deep into the actors. I usually just cover the first, you know, four major ones. But I had to talk about Gordon Harker, who played Jack's trainer. I loved this guy in this film, so I really wanted to talk about him. So he was an English stage and film actor, and he had a long career on the stage from 1902 to the 50s. One of the last plays he starred in was Small Hotel, which was a popular comedy that he toured in 1955. He appeared in 68 films between 1921 and 1959, including three silent films by Hitchcock. He was in several scenes in Elm Street Calling, which was a film co-directed by Hitchcock. And he is known for his performance as Inspector Hornley in a trilogy of films between 1938 and 1940, as well as in Saloon Bar from 1940. Now, Harker was one of the sons of Sarah Elizabeth Harker and Joseph Harker, much-admired set painter for the theater for whom Dracula character Jonathan Harker was named. So I wanted to talk about that guy because I thought he was awesome.
Right on.
Now, one interesting thing. I don't know if you guys noticed it because I did. The wording of the intertitle made me look this up. And they said when they introduced the referee for the fight at the end of the film, they said it's Mr. Eugene Corey. So I immediately Googled, and I found out that Eugene Corey was a boxing referee, and he was very well known and very popular in the UK, and he was also himself a boxer in his youth. So they actually got a real-life boxing referee to play this referee.
Right on.
He played himself. So I thought that was really interesting. He makes an appearance as himself in this movie. He's introduced the audience by the MC. He was one of the original members of the National Sporting Club, and he published several books, including 50 Years in the Ring, which appeared the summer before he died. He died in Southend on the 21st of December, 1933.
Hmm.
Now, did you guys catch the Hitchcock cameo in this film?
I did not.
No.
That's because there was no Hitchcock cameo in this picture. And then, now the last episode we discussed, we also talked about how brandy was apparently in every film. Did you guys find the brandy in this film?
Well, the champagne, right? There's no brandy per se.
I couldn't find any brandy. Mm. I found the champagne and the ale, but I couldn't find any
brandy.
Maybe
it's in the party scene.
I don't think they left any brandy after that wedding party.
Oh my God.
There was none left after that.
Yes. But yeah, so Hitchcock did, contrary to popular belief, Hitchcock did not make an appearance in every single one of his films. And this is one of the few where he did not.
Now that's why you listen to our podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
To find out these important things.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Right on.
Interesting.
So what did you guys think of the film? I mean, I think we've touched on a little bit of what Brandon Shea thinks.
I was 50-50 on it. Like, again, it was, as a silent film, there's that barrier. It's a difficult film to watch, and you end up, like I said, watching the version that I had with the music attached, you end up thinking about the music and getting distracted and thinking, you know, where did this music come from and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. It was interesting, but nothing I would rush back or nothing that I would recommend to anybody.
Yeah. Fair enough. I mean, because I only watched it for the first time today, and it's, the ones we've watched at the moment, because a lot of them unfortunately have been quite patchy, or they've been, you know, it's only been like surviving fragments or that sort of thing. It's the one that's got the most cohesive plot I've seen, but it's also the thinnest plot, because it is basically Rocky with like a love triangle in it. And for an hour and 20 minutes, there's not a lot that actually goes on.
Right.
So I was just a bit like, okay, so, you know, Nellie's in love with Jack, but then she starts to fall in love with Bob, and there's all that sort of thing. But it just seems, I mean, it might be because it's a silent film, or it might be because we're used to sort of expecting a bit more to happen, or kind of a less, you know, sedate pace or anything. But I was like, it's okay. It's not a bad film, and I quite liked a few of the motifs that are present in it, and some of the early kind of trick photography things that Hitchcock used and some of the transitions. But as like an actual film, I just thought it was a bit, I don't know, just a bit lackluster, and which might actually tie into why kind of after he'd, because as you said, you know, it's the first one he ever wrote on his own, and it's the only one he ever wrote on his own. And apparently he had trouble with, like, dialogue and stuff. So that might be why he kind of relied on other collaborators in the future to try and, like, make kind of punchier stories.
This movie seemed like it had a lot of dialogue happening on the screen that we didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
The number of intertitles were very few and far between.
Well, that's...
Yeah, there was quite a few... There was not very many intertitles at all.
Yeah.
And, again, it relies very heavily, as most silent films do, on the facial expressions, on the body language, and it leaves a lot up to the audience to fill in the blanks and to know what's happening.
Yeah.
Did you guys find the characters clearly defined, easy to distinguish?
Oh, God, no.
I did myself. Like I've got to take a completely different stance on this from you guys here, because I really enjoyed this movie this time around watching it. And I was kind of interested in right from the beginning with the first fight scenes that this one round Jack was doing. So this guy is basically, he's a strong man in a traveling circus. And so people pay to try and see if they can knock him down. And he wins every time, basically, right? And I thought that Hitchcock's style of directing right from the get-go was awesome because, you know, we've got this trainer, again, this guy that I really liked. He brings the guy into the ring, takes off his coat, like makes this big show of like folding it up nicely and whatnot. And then as soon as the guy stands up and walks off camera, we don't see the fight that happens between One Round Jack and this paying customer. All that we see is this guy unfolding the jacket and holding it up, getting ready for the guy to get knocked out like right away. And I'm like, I don't know. I was laughing. I normally don't laugh at old silent films. I don't think the humor translates really well, but I was really captivated by this trainer, and I thought it was funny, and I thought the style of Hitchcock directing and not showing us what's going on was wonderful.
Yeah. I know. I mean, it is worth pointing out there is some humor in it, because there's that scene you mentioned, and there's like just bits of comedy sprinkled throughout. So there's like the wedding scene, or at the altar where the rings are lost. And he's just like, what's going on? He's dead. Just like, that sort of thing. It's not as much.
There's a lot of slapstick.
A bit of slapstick. There was a bit of like physical comedy in it, which I enjoyed, and I thought it was quite good. The setups and everything.
The audience of that day would have been used to vaudeville. They would have been used to slapstick. They would have found the drunk character very funny.
Yeah.
And he's a rube. You know, he's picking his nose at the altar, and I've never said that phrase before. And there was a lot of lowbrow comedy, which is fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with that.
But to be fair, it fits the medium as well, because you can't really tell a really good like one-liner in a silent movie, because you have da-da-da talking, and then it comes up the line. It might get a few laughs, but it's not the same as seeing a guy pick his nose as the best man in a wedding, or, you know, the entire setup with the coat and everything. So yeah, it does fit. I think the problem I've got, and it's something I don't really like in films as a general, I don't really like love triangles.
Yeah.
I just
bizarre love triangle.
I think it's just that they've just been done to death. So yeah. it's not a thing for me. One thing I did notice, and I don't know if you guys saw, and I made notes throughout, because I just kept seeing this, how, despite the fact it isn't black and white and everything, how they do use colour as like alongside the character, which I thought was really cool. So like, starting off, you see Bob emerge, because there's all these guys in the striking white coats, and they're supposed to, you know, symbolise like gentility and you know, purity and honour and all that sort of thing. But then you see, because Jack is always tends to be framed in lighter colours, you've got Bob, who tends to be in like darker colours and shadow and everything, and then you've got Nelly in the middle, and her allegiance, or where her heart goes, tends to switch or blend depending on who she's actually with. So for example, when you first see her in front of the stall, she's wearing like quite a light summery dress, you know, everything like that, and obviously in the wedding dress it's quite bright and everything. And then when she has that first kiss with Jack, everything's in shadow, the dress is darker. She has that first kiss with Bob, sorry, not Jack. When she has the first kiss with Bob, Bob's in like a dark suit, she's in darker clothing. And then when she, you know, when there's the party and he's waiting for Nelly and Nelly never turns up, and then she eventually arrives and she's in this kind of black, slinky, lacy, very kind of pre-haze code clothing. And it was just interesting to see how it kind of shifted, and then by the end, because the final scene is Jack versus Bob at the Albert Hall, and Nellie's there waiting, she's got the big, like, oversized mink fur coat on and everything, and then once she sees that Jack's hurt, she rushes to his side, and the coat's gone, and underneath it's just, like, the simple clothing again, and it's that sort of reinforcement. And then even Jack and Bob, they're wearing the appropriate coloured trunks of their alignment. So like Jack, if you notice, he's wearing like white boxer shorts, Bob is wearing black, So it's like that kind of like temptation versus, you know, the purity of marriage thing. So I just thought it was interesting how that was coded, because normally you think of like all the colour, psychology of colour in film is usually with like technicolour or with like coloured films. But I'm really impressed with Hitchcock how he managed to do that even with a black and white.
That's a very good observation, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Now, like, we're going to talk a little bit about spoilers for the end. So in a nutshell, going on, so what happened is this Bob guy is actually a professional boxer, and he doesn't tell them that when he goes into the ring with him at the circus. So he wins right away. And so he ends up hiring One Round Jack as his sparring partner as a way to get closer to his soon-be wife at that time, because he's attracted to her. And, I mean, like, I kind of don't like love triangles as well. And I mean, like, especially with this one woman, like, this one woman is such a dislikable character in this movie, you know? And, like, with her going after this other guy, like, she accepts these gifts from him, which are, in my opinion, it's inappropriate, right? And even in a day, if this movie were to take place right now and it was portrayed in the same manner, I would say this woman's in the wrong, you know? Like, at the end of the movie, like, I wasn't happy with the end of the movie when she, like, in a nutshell, she's back with her husband and everything's forgiven within a matter of like 60 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't happy with the end of the film, but I get the impression that this would have been a satisfying ending in 1927.
It's the classic, it's almost like a sitcom generic storyline where everything ends up at the end of the story the same as it was at the beginning. And it's a very simple to digest, easy to follow, not complicated storyline, very forward-moving storyline that just comes back to where it started from, and very simple for the audience to consume.
Yeah.
Like this One Round Jack, like, in my opinion, he's an idiot. Like, yeah. You know, I don't know. Like, he's going through this whole... But maybe this is the lens of 90 years later in our society with how it is now. But he basically, to win his wife back, he's going to work his way up the boxing championship stats so that he can fight this guy Bob in the ring and win his wife back. Like, I don't know. Again, I really enjoyed the movie and I really liked it. But, I mean, this guy's an idiot.
Yeah.
You're going to go in the ring and tell him he's an idiot?
I will.
In this corner, wearing a Star Trek t-shirt.
Brandon, the smart guy.
The master podcaster.
Oh, that's good. I quite like that. I do get what you mean, though. I mean, because she isn't, like, really likable from the start anyway. She is just this kind of... She's like, oh, yeah, kind of... And I sort of... If it had been from her perspective, I might have empathised with her a bit more, in that if she's like, well, if she is stuck in like this kind of boring relationship with a guy who is very well meaning but he's kind of, you know, dull as dishwater, and then this exciting guy rocks up and everything like that, and it's not to excuse her behaviour, but it's, I can sort of see where she's coming from, but she doesn't get any of that. She's literally, I mean, to be fair, at least she got that kind of, it's an interesting role, because normally in a movie like that, it'd be much more, she's just the supportive wife, and they'd make it more of like a drama between the two guys. I reckon if you did it nowadays and you tried to adapt it, it would be more about Jack and Bob's relationship and their rivalry.
She's the big attraction that they're fighting over, and is she really that appealing of a prize, of a bride to be chasing?
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, I think the ending's quite weird, not just in, like, the way that it's instantly, like, she sees his hurt and all of a sudden it's like, oh, no, I really do love him and all that sort of thing. But I literally mean, like, the last 2 minutes of the film, because it's like, and again, spoilers, you know, Jack wins, he's, like, reinvigorated with the power of love and all that kind of crap. Sorry, power of love is true, but I do not believe it in this film. Whatever. So they have a big, like, it's like the end of Rocky. It's like, oh, Nelly, oh, Jack, and what sort of thing. And she looks at Bob, which, side note, I cannot, genuinely, I'm really glad about the clothing thing that I mentioned, because I could not tell Jack and Bob apart sometimes.
Yeah.
Because really? I genuinely, like, I don't know if it's like some kind of like face prosopagnosia or something. The faces, I was like, nope, you are both exactly the same, I guess? Or, I don't know if it was just like a certain look, and I just was like, no, I don't get it.
It was funny when Bob Corby enters the ring at the beginning when they're in the tent at the circus,
yeah,
and he's wearing his way, like, these men are fighting shirtless, and he's got his dress shirt buttoned up, and he rolls up his sleeves. I think is he wearing a bow tie, or he takes his bow tie off, but, you know, he's so casual about, and everyone's looking at him like, what a nerd, you know, this is how he fights, but they don't realize that he's a professional fighter, so he's kind of pulling their chain, as it were.
Well, that's it, he's doing it for the performance of it. He's like, oh yeah, you think I'm going to get my ass handed to me? Think again. But no, so they have their reunion and everything, and Nelly looks over at Bob, and she takes off this, it's like a bracelet sort of thing that he'd given her, and looks right at him and, like, discards it. And then the last scene of the movie isn't that kind of joyful reunion. It's on Bob in his dressing room, and someone brings him the bracelet and says, hey, look what we found. And he just takes it and looks at it, and then just throws it. He just goes, all
right. Well, he says to the other guy, he can have it, right?
Yeah, it's just like,
it's gone.
Which I just, if they'd even lingered for a moment, I could have understood it or been like, no, you're okay. But he just seems so unfazed about the whole thing afterwards. In, like, the last few seconds, he's like, oh, well, that sort of thing. It's like, you know, the whole tone of it, just the ending, it just seemed really weird. And, like, how it was edited and everything. I do like the, you know, it's in that same kind of last 5 minutes of the film where it's like Jack's defeated and he looks into the bucket of water, and I think it's supposed to be Bob's reflection, isn't it, in the water? It's supposed to be like a trick.
Well, it's her reflection.
Oh, is it her reflection?
Is that what he notices? It's hers.
I am blind then.
Yeah, it's her.
He saw the reflection of the woman he loves in his spit bucket, though. Like, that's kind of a horrible image.
I do like how they were dribbling champagne in the hair, though. Like you said, that was a thing that used to happen. They used to have champagne everywhere.
I was watching. I'm like, are they pouring champagne on this?
Wouldn't that burn your eyes?
I don't know.
Maybe it's supposed to, like, kind of zest you up a bit. You know, maybe they thought it was a bit of energy. Who knows? Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, part of, again, why I don't like this woman, like, she's got an 8x10 of this Bob guy, like, sitting on her piano at a home. So she's, like, playing the piano and, like, oogling over this picture of this other guy in their house.
Yeah.
Like, oogling. I don't know about you. Like, Tom's married. Chris, you're not, right?
Yeah.
You know, my wife has a picture framed 8x10 of some other dude. I'm not happy.
Yeah.
You know, like...
You come in there, she just sat doing something, and there's, like, an 8x10 of, like, Channing Tatum or Idris Elba, then you're like, oh, okay.
Well, Idris Elba, that's one thing.
Right? Yeah.
You know, Channing Tatum, no. Idris Elba's okay, though.
Okay. I love the idea that just two examples, and you're just like, okay, I can forgive Elba. Elba has a place in my heart, too. But Channing Tatum, just like,
pfft. So, I noticed another triangle in the film, which is the ring being the wedding ring, and then the boxing ring, and then this bracelet, which I'm referring to as a ring because it's a symbolic gift between lovers. And it's a bracelet, which is a snake. And I'm sure the women will have a better phrase for the bracelet that you can wear on the bicep, or, you know, it goes up the arm. It's larger than a bracelet. But one of the critics referred to it as original sin, the snake, you know.
Good symbolism.
Again, we talked previously about Hitchcock likes his triangle. So there's a love triangle. There's a triangle of the three different rings. Kind of has a forward shadow to it a little bit, the three rings. But were there any other trilogies or triangles in the film that I'm not thinking of?
Well, other than the Lord of the Rings.
No, but in this film here.
That was a good trilogy of rings.
Yeah, but in this film... in particular. So, but the symbolism and the comedy around the ring at the altar was quite funny in a way. kind of distracting.
At the wedding?
Yeah.
I thought the wedding scene was great as well, because you got all these... It was then that I realized that he was a circus performer, because I didn't quite catch that at the beginning, right? But when all of a sudden, you know, like these conjoined twins come in, and they're like fighting over which side of the aisle they want to sit on, where they're like trying to pull apart, I thought that was great. And then this like giant guy comes in with this little person, and they're like right next to each other. And so I thought that was kind of interesting that there was some of those things. I'm like, okay, I see what's going on here now. And that like the pastor, the priest is like just like revolted by these people in the audience. Like he just gives this crazy double take. But in the wedding scene as well, like there was a lot of wonderful imagery in this movie. Yeah. And one of them is like when he slips the ring on her finger and that bracelet slips down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, to show that he's still intruding on their life.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a lot of like crossfading and stuff that was used throughout the film to really good effect.
And there was a visual montage that was apparently a big hit in the theater. Like it got a lot of applause or a lot of oohs and ahs in the theater. They were like, because video editing or film editing at the time was very basic. So for them to have, I think it was a montage of a drunk party they were having and everyone was dancing. Yeah. And there were some camera tricks in there that were pretty advanced for the day. And so technically a fairly advanced film.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was there was one, I think, and it was the same, it's the party sequence, but it's like they managed to distort the piano playing. So it's not it's playing piano, but it's just all like...
Well, I think it was the point of view of his trainer who was like drunk off of the ale, right? Because there was a lot of like blurry images at that point.
If I'm correct, camera-wise, what they do is they reflect everything off of a mirror that's underwater, under an inch of water, and they ripple the water. And then the mirror image distorts. But he also did a famous Hitchcock camera trick of the point of view, first person point of view from the fighter in the boxing ring.
Yeah.
Which is very unique. And at the time would have been tricky to pull off. The cameras weren't really that agile back then.
Mm-hmm.
The cameras were the size of your odd Volkswagen car, some of them. So to pull that off would have been a lot of work for the...
Well, they weren't that big. I mean, they were pretty small. They would sit beside them and stuff. But there's pictures in... I've got behind-the-scenes photos that they're not that big.
Either way.
Yeah.
Anywho, I don't know. Like, I like this movie a lot. I'd give it 3 KOs.
3 KOs out of what?
Out of 5. 3 out of 5 KOs.
I was using the scale of cleaned-off kitchen knives. Out of 5, I would give it, probably a 2 out of 5.
Yeah. I'd give it like 3 out of 5 adulterous arm cuffs.
I don't like this woman at all.
No. No, she's not great, is she?
Anything else? Final thoughts?
I'm good with that. I think we've done a pretty good summary here, and it's interesting how such a simple film can have so much to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Well, just let everybody know that the next film we'll be talking about next month is going to be Downhill. And if you haven't picked up The Lodger from Criterion yet, it is a full 2K restoration included on that disc as a bonus feature, the complete version of Downhill. So I'm looking forward to seeing that because The Lodger transfer sure looked darn good. It definitely looked a lot better than this DVD copy of The Ring that I had.
Yeah. That'll be a good one to look forward to for sure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. You can find us at the Fandom Podcast Network. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. The Good Evening Alfred Hitchcock Podcast Twitter is Good Evening Pod, if I'm right. Yep, awesome. You can contact us. You can listen to episodes through the Fandom Podcast Network. I'm trying to think if there's anything else.
Facebook at Good Evening Alfred. What is it?
Hitchcock Good Evening on Facebook.
Hitchcock Good Evening on Facebook. I mean, do you guys want to talk about your own?
Again, I'm available on Instagram, which, as I like to say, is a lot of photos of my dog. And I'm also put a bit of a listing up on IMDb. Brandon Shea, where can we find you?
I am on Twitter at Brandon Metella, and you can find me over on Trek FM with a couple of shows. I've got one more episode of Melodic Treks to come out. I'm on Warp 5, which is our Star Trek Enterprise show with my friend Floyd. And you can find me on The Edge, which is our Star Trek Discovery podcast. And it's a lot of fun over there. So check those things out. But yeah, follow me on Twitter. Send us some notes. Send us some feedback, and we'll read it on the show.
Please. Right on.
Right on. You can find me on Twitter at @higher_boy. Apart from Good Evening, I also do a podcast with one of my best mates, Emma Platt. It is North by Nerd West, which is a cheeky little Hitchcock reference because I just can't get away from him. It is a very weird, funny, nerdy show, and we just kind of talk and go on weird tangents, but it is really funny, so I hope you guys check that out. We are available on iTunes. You can check us out on Twitter at North by Nerd West, and you can always drop us an email at northbynerdwestpod@gmail.com. So I think that's everything for tonight, guys.
I think so.
Yeah, I think that's all that is left to say is good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
And as we move away from Tom's synopsis of the movie, we are now going to touch in with